Hey everyone, this is Jerry Fabian, KYGT, LPFM 102.7, 103.9, coming at you once again live here, very center of this universe in Clear Creek County, Colorado. And this is Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole, and just having a great conversation. We just wrapped up with Doug Fain and his work, new work coming out, Anarchists for Rent. And in the studio with me is Grady Birdsong, and we're going to be talking about his work, To the Sound of Guns. And Grady is a veteran in a couple ways. One, we'll talk about that, military, but he's also a veteran of the show here too. So welcome back, Grady.
Well, thank you, Jerry, for having me, and thank your audience also.
Oh, absolutely. And I know we just had a call in, and gentleman says how much he enjoyed the conversations that we're having here. So appreciate that. I am bringing you this next hour. And again, you can find out more about my work at jerryfabianic.com, and that's Sisyphus Wins. But I want to thank all of our sponsors, because without sponsors, community radio like this, not possible. I do want to give a shout out to the businesses up in Georgetown who signed on and, you know, promoting what's happening in town there, which is always quite a bit. And so thank you there. And also Tommyknockers, I think you got short shrifted here a little bit too. And if you get a chance to get over to Tommyknockers and get the nut brown ale and so forth, that'd be great. But in the meantime, let's talk here with Grady. And Grady Birdsong is the son of a old field roughneck driller and tool pusher and homemaker mother, was raised in the small town values of God, Mother, Country, and apple pie in that order. He grew up in central and southwest Kansas, attending Southwestern College in Winfield, Kansas, before enlisting in the Marine Corps in 1966. After serving two combat tours in the Northern I Corps, region of Vietnam during the Tet Offensive in 1968 and along the DMZ in 1969. He returned to Denver and finished his formal education at Regis University in Denver. During his actual education, he traveled the globe, enjoying a successful career in marketing and business development, telecommunications data, and cable fiber optic industries. He's now retired and lives with his wife, Pamela, in the Denver area, where he enjoys his grandchildren and spends time riding, puttering, and hunting big game. You were just out elk hunting, weren't you?
That's correct.
And did you bring any meat back?
Not this year.
Dang.
But my buddy did. My sailor buddy did.
Okay.
Oh, he got a big one. But I got in on humping it down the hill.
All right. Well, you got to bring the Marines to work, right?
That's right.
There you go.
The Marines did the work.
Oh, yeah. And you have a private license. You're a pilot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I am.
Boy Scout leader and Toastmasters International. I wasn't aware of that, Brady. Grady, I'm sorry.
Yeah, we started a Toastmasters club up when I worked for Storage Technology Corporation, and I was one of the founders along with another fellow, Byron Flightland, and we had a good time. We learned a lot of things.
Nice.
Not to say between.
Yeah, one of those there. But you're quite an accomplishment here. And, you know, in what you've done in your life and do. And we got to know each other pretty well through SEPA, and you've been on the radio before here. So just enjoy just talking it up with you here. You know, I didn't realize you were a speech, speechifier too.
Well, I was a debater in high school, and I dearly loved it, even though I had to take English a couple of times. But I did. I liked the debate, I became a debate judge when I went to college at Southwestern College, the high school tournaments, so on and so forth. And I think we won as a sophomore. My partner and I, my best friend in high school, Barry Clay, we won the Oberlin Debate Tournament in Kansas, which was the premier debate tournament at the time in the 60s. So we were walking on tall clouds at the time, but I really enjoyed it.
Nice. And you become a writer now, too, in your own right.
If you would have told me back then I was going to write, I would have told you were crazy.
Mm-hmm. And doing some great work here. We're going to get to your recent work here, To the Sound of the Guns. But you were on before, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, you know, on your previous works, but I do want to touch on them a little bit, particularly the
Miracle Workers of South Boulder Road.
Yeah.
Healing the Signature Wounds of War.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an overview on that book, myself and Colonel Robert Fisher wrote the book about our efforts as veteran advocates to tell the story of a couple of young men, a very good doctor, Dr. Julie Stapleton, and a retired Sergeant Major, Pepe Ramirez from the Marine Corps, who those four miracle workers formed a team in Louisville. They started out in Boulder, formed a team in Louisville to treat traumatic brain injuries from returning war veterans from the Middle Eastern wars. They use hyperbaric oxygen treatment therapy to do that, and it has been a huge success over the last few years since this technique was discovered. Mm-hmm. I believe we're over 400 veterans that we've sent through the clinic with an appreciable amount of success up in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah, no, it's an amazing story. You know, when you think about the intensity of what can happen to the human brain, you know, through, you know, it could be combat right now in Afghanistan, for example, certainly in Vietnam,
right?
But other circumstances in life too, it creates that PTSD.
Oh, there's billions of car accident, traumatic brain injuries. On the football field now, all starting out, and I see where they're trying to ban football up to over the age of 12 now.
Mm-hmm.
No football under the age of 12.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to work out. But
well, it's and because studies are showing, and I get the initials, I can never say the word, but CTF, it's that chronic traumatic brain injury. And they diagnosed Aaron Hernandez.
That's correct.
And had a severe case in the Junior Seau. Yeah. So there's a lot to be said there about the
Lyle Elzado back when we were growing up, or when we were young men in Denver here in the 70s, 80s.
Yeah, you keep smacking that head around. But also it could be psychological too. Woman, or it could be a guy too, you know, in terms of abuse in a relationship. But there's a number of reasons, that can, cause that to happen. But what the work they're doing up there at the clinic has just been short of miraculous.
And I'm humbled to be a part of that. Colonel Fisher and I are very honored to be a part of that, and we're trying to get the awareness out in the military community. And the health community. That was the reason for the book. Mm-hmm. And just to tell your audience, I didn't think anything about it at the time, but we won two first places Evie Awards, and another award, Best Book Awards. That's mm-hmm. a USA award.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, no, it's a great work, and I thoroughly, I not only enjoyed it but learned so much, of that. And I've passed a word on, I have a friend who is a counselor, works with the military vets, coming back. He lives in North Carolina. So I brought that to his attention, for him to look at. But, anything I could do to spread the word, I'm doing it there. But I want to lead into your next work here, To the Sound of the Guns. And just a little bit of background, because I'll never get the title exactly right, because it's about your battalion in Vietnam. And
yes, this book, the reason I wrote it, I wrote it for our KIAs, Killed in Actions. The book is dedicated to those men and their families who were the KIAs, and to the men who endured the tour and came home to their loved ones. We lost, inside of 6 months in the Tet Offensive of 1968, 112 men, and we had almost 700 Purple Hearts awarded during that time period while we were engaged with the enemy in the Hue City area, and then later on Operation Allenbrook down south of Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and that's something that I was talking to Doug about earlier. But when I think of the Vietnam War, and it's hard to believe it's 50 years now. This is the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive.
This April 17th will be an anniversary date for me. We sustained an assault on our CP command post. We lost five killed in actions, and about, I think there was 25 or 26 wounded in actions on that date. I was a new guy, and that was my first taste of combat. It was right before Easter, and believe me, that was the most down period of my time over there beginning. There was more to come later on.
Yeah, and it's a story to be told. It continued to be told, I should say.
That's correct.
Yeah, you know, and I think of World War II, and oftentimes, you know, we think of, you know, the great movies about it, Saving Private Ryan, perhaps, but, you know, The Guns of Navarone and Midway, you know, the battle in the Pacific, and there's all these epic battles. But when I think of Vietnam, I don't think of it in as grandiose terms with that, you know, certainly, and we'll talk about this at the Alan Brooks battle.
Let's back up just a skosh here. 1968 was the defining year in Vietnam, we basically got caught with our pants down, so to speak. However, we won all of the battles after that. The major battles were, the first one was the battle for Hue City and the Citadel. That began on January 31st of 1968. That's the one that you hear about the most, along with Khe Sanh. That was a 77-day siege up in the northwest part of the I Corps area in South Vietnam. The other two big operations, multi-battalion operations by maneuver battalions like ourselves, were Operation Alan Brooke and Operation Mameluke Thrust, okay, which engaged a lot of Marines. This was the year that Walter Cronkite, of course, came out and said we're at a stalemate. And I've got a quote here in my research. Admiral Ulysses Grant Sharp, who was the Pacific commander, he was like Mattis was when he was in charge of all of the Middle Eastern theaters before he became defense secretary. And Ulysses Grant Sharp said about the offensive, he said, after victory at Khe Sanh, he says, they got so damned hysterical back in Washington over the Tet Offensive that they sort of went off the deep end and decided to get the war over with, even if we weren't going to win it. And that's an actual quote from the admiral after the fact. So, but to take that a little further, we won all of the battles. A lot of people don't know that. We won all the battles, 90% of them, 98, 99% of them. But our upper-level politicians, that administration let us down. And so we're perceived as not winning the war. Go ahead.
Yeah, and there's an interesting, because it was like a double battlefront. One is the actual war itself, and then there was the scene at home, the
right,
political one here, and how that was going. And there seemed to be, and I remember there in the, it was interesting for me reading the first part of your book in terms of the, we'll say the political dynamics within the military, because there was, I think you have a quote in there about General William Westmoreland,
right,
not having a very high opinion of the Marines, that they couldn't fight or something like that. What was the line there? Implying that Westmoreland began implying the Marines were afraid to take the fight to the enemy. That's a pretty powerful statement there.
General William Westmoreland he was not in favor of the Marine Corps being up in the I Corps area. and he did not want to be upstaged. He was a World War II artillery officer, you know, just march to the sound of the guns and get it over with and forget, you know, the villagers. But he had a lot of conflicts with not only the Marines in the theater. We called it the 3rd MAF, M-A-F, Marine Amphibious Force. Cushman, General Cushman, was in charge of that theater. He didn't trust them. So after the Tet Offensive broke out, why, he sent General Abrams up to Fubai, which is right below Hoi City, about, maybe 6-7 miles. Mm-hmm. And they established a what they call MACV Forward, Military Assistance Command Vietnam Forward. Mm-hmm. And he basically put Abrams in charge of the whole Northern I Corps area. And General Krulak, who was the whole commander of the whole Pacific of the Marine Corps, he did not like that, and Cushman didn't like it. And they worked it out. They worked with Abrams, but there was a lot of difficulties. Westmoreland did not trust the Marine Corps. From this is what I've gathered from my reading. Now let me qualify that. I've done all this. I'm speaking from the research that I've done. Mm-hmm. Have done. When I was a Lance Corporal over there, a corporal later on, I had not a clue what was going on.
Right. You're doing your job.
I'm just doing my job. I didn't even know where we were at half the time. I just to tell you how in the dark we were, I knew we were at a city called Way, and I spelled it W-A-Y. Yeah.
Which makes sense phonetically.
But anyway.
Yeah, and it's something I picked up, and I get your reaction to it, Grady. When I watched the Ken Burns series, and one of the criticism, and I think it came even from the military, about Westmoreland and so forth, was the approach to Vietnam, you know, that they took World War II tactics. Mm-hmm. And try to apply them to Vietnam without ever understanding that it was a completely different kind of war.
Yes.
Is that a valid statement?
That's a valid statement. That is a very valid
Explain
statement.
Explain that, then, for our audience.
Just to give you a thumbnail sketch of what was actually pretty successful, and General Abrams verified this later on, and some people will tell you that if Abrams had been in charge the whole time, why, the war would have gone differently. But we had what we called a combined action group over there. What that was where the Marines principally did this combined action group or civil action platoons. They put Marines in the village. It was actually, to make a long story short, Peace Corps with rifles. They lived with the villagers. They helped them develop their infrastructure. They protected them with security. They went on ambushes at night to keep the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese away from the villages so they wouldn't come in and take their rice, which is what they wanted. And they needed manpower. They would take the young men and conscript them into the North Vietnamese army. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and
does that answer your question?
It does, yeah. And, you know, because I want to just put some background into the complexity of the whole situation there. And there was a couple others that you mentioned, and I talk about mispronunciating Vietnamese, but General Giap.
Oh, yes.
North Vietnam.
Yes.
And what I picked up from your work is that had – the Americans come in with the same type. Well, first of all, I don't think he expected the support from China and Russia to stay there. Is that accurate?
This has been found out later on, yes.
Okay.
Now, that was one of President Johnson's at McNamara's big fears at the time. Now, I've gleaned all of this from my reading. Their big fear was that China or Russia or both would come in and get involved in the war with their mm-hmm. troops. And that's why Johnson micromanaged, that's why McNamara micromanaged the war like they did. We could go into detail on that all day long, mm-hmm. but that's neither here nor there. But later on, I have in certain sources, I don't have them in front of me right now, but Chinese and the Russians would not have gone into the war themselves, sending troops. They were providing beans and bullets. They would have continued to do that. But and one of the evidences of that is they would not allow any of their advisors that they sent to the North Vietnamese, they would not allow them to take any pictures, or they would not allow them to, you know, have their names displayed in any newspaper articles or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And we did capture some Chinese in the Hoi City area, 1st Battalion, 27th Marines. I remember having them right there at the CP. Mm-hmm. One of our line companies brought a couple, or one of them in, and then there was another one at another time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you had in General Nguyen Khi, president.
Oh, yeah.
And he was the prime minister of the Republic.
That's
correct. Yeah, because I think Thieu was the president. Yeah, because
that's correct.
There was a lot of conflict between them, and then Thieu won. That was after they overthrew Diem in 63, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And it's just, I mean, it's the complexity of what was going on. It was pretty amazing. And he says that, but Khi has said his country would have been better suited and equipped had the effort been approached like China and Russia did in their economic and material support to the North Vietnamese. And he's, you know, as you were just saying there, do you agree with that then?
I don't know. I just know what I've read in my research. If you read General Key's book, he was pretty confident that had we advised them and gave them beans and bullets and let them fight the war, they would have done a lot better.
So because towards the end there, it was that whole process, and I think it's in the early 70s, the Vietnamization of the war to turn.
Yeah, that's when Nixon came in. He started that concept of the Vietnamization of the war, to let them fight it. We had the right amount of pressure on them with the bombings in the north, and that brought them to the Paris peace table. Mm-hmm. But we didn't, looking back now, this is afterthought, we didn't continue that. We pulled out, and then our Congress shut off all the funds, and they finally got overran. We abandoned them.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the way I look at it. That's my own personal opinion.
Well, and that's what I think the whole situation, you know, because I've talked to individuals who watched, for example, the Ken Burns series and come away with it in very different points of view and so forth there. But I think it's a something, I mean, you know, we need to study more, learn more of.
Yeah, if you talk to some of the advisors, I know two of them specifically. My executive officer, Colonel Pete Eller, mm-hmm. and his best friend at Annapolis, Colonel Robert Fisher, who helped me with the other book, The Miracle Workers, mm-hmm. They were both what they call COVANs. They were advisors to the Vietnamese Marine Corps. They brought the Marine Corps they helped bring the Marine Corps into existence in the early 60s. I think Pete was over there in 1965. He was in one of the first big battles that was fought in the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. He's a Silver Star recipient, by the way. But anyway, both of them will tell you that had we given them beans and bullets towards the end there in the 70s, 72, 73, 74, 75, why, he said those Marine Corps units would have held them off. There were some good Vietnamese units over there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then all that gets to play into the political situation
here. Yeah, it was all political.
And then, wearing down it. But come back to your work there, because, you know, sure. I mean, it's a – it's a very serious work, and I compliment you. And I'm going like, oh my gosh! I mean, the amount of detail that you have put into this, Grady, you know, is just, you know, mind-blowing.
Well, thank you.
I am just like, but there was one, I was reading it, you called it the beer ration incident.
Oh, that was by my company commander, Jesse Hand.
You talk about it, because I found it's just, you know, as lighthearted in a way, and I've been like, yeah, okay, you know, to find some, you know, light, you know.
First Lieutenant Jesse Hand, believe me, he'll laugh about it now, but it wasn't funny at the time.
Right. Explain, you know, because it's a fun part of the book for me, but, what I read.
Yeah, right. To make a long story short, Jesse, when he was telling me this story, he was telling me, he says, our upper level brass in their infinite wisdom decided that we needed a beer ration when the Marines and the corpsmen came out of the field. And he says, that was kind of fallacious because some of them didn't drink, and mm-hmm. they'd give their ration to the ones that did. And he mm-hmm. says they had a tendency to get off, you know, out of hand. And he says that's what happened in the beer ration incident. He said you had two units, you know, and you've got pride in your unit. Two companies. One was, I think, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines. They were handing the area off to us. And then you had the 1st Battalion, 27th Marines, the guys that were in the perimeter there. And they got all drunked up one night, and there was a standoff with weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesse took his first sergeant, and they got right in the middle of it. And he said, I had to think real quick. He says, I said, attention. And he says, being good Marines, they all came to attention, even though they were drunk. And he says, First Sergeant, march them off. He defused the whole situation. It was funny the way he told it. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. I found it, you know, lighthearted, humorous, and everything. And it could have been, you know, very tragic, too, you know, the way it ended.
Yes.
But still, and, you know, and how an organization, you know, we're going to limit everybody to two beers. Well, not everybody drinks beer. Okay, so if I'm one who does drink beer and say, you know, I have a very valuable commodity here, so what can I sell this for? That's human behavior. And, of course, you know, the brainiacs at the very top don't think about that. They just make, you know, these assumptions that everyone thinks just like us. It's like, no, you know.
Well, it led to when they got back to the compound there, they couldn't carry loaded weapons around.
Because they were loaded.
even though we were in a free fire zone.
That's hilarious. But, everyone, this is Jerry Fabiani, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9, coming at you live here from the center of the universe. Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole here, and visiting with my good friend Grady Birdsong, and his story, you know, to the sound of the guns, and you know, about Vietnam. And I'm very timely on this, you know, given it the 50th anniversary, and you know, in 1968, turning point in a war, perhaps, you know, or at least the way it was, you know, crucial time, Tet Offensive and everything too. So and a very thorough work. And before I lose this too much, this thought here, I want to come back to some, I've got a number of points I want to make. It's a story, you know, you're talking about this other, but I wonder how much of this is memoir for you, you know, that you get in there. Because I think when I think of Vietnam, it's, I don't think of the big grand battles, you know, like the Battle of the Bulge or something like this. But I think of the individuals. I had a couple of brothers over there.
Yeah, this was counterinsurgency warfare. This was my first 6 months over there. I went to another unit after this unit. What happened is this unit was called home. This unit was sent over there on a moment's notice mm-hmm. when President Johnson, after the Tet Offensive had broken out. The unit's colors were sent home. So what they did is they brought all of the Marines that were due to rotate home on their normal 13-month tour when that was over. They put them with the 27th Marines, and they followed the flag home, so it looked like they were bringing a unit home. The rest of us that still had time in country went to other units that needed manpower. I went to 2-9, 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, hell in a helmet up on a DMC. So I haven't told the other 13 months story that of what happened when I was over there. I went up to the DMC.
And this obviously was a life-changing period in your time. I mean, you're a young man back in your early 20s.
It made me stronger. I was pretty numb when I came out of there. I drank a lot, like all of us. We self-medicated, it took me a lot of years. I had survivor's guilt, like every other Marine that come home alive. We left our brothers over there, our KIAs. There's not a day that doesn't go by that any one of us don't think about our dead.
Yeah.
Or Vietnam.
Yeah. I mean, powerful time in our history there. But in your work, you know, I said about how thorough it is, and it was interesting. I was reading, and I call it like the tools of the trade. I mean, you really get into some specifics there. You know, what, I mean, the everyday life, you know, like a day in the life of a soldier there. And talk about that. You know, what are those elements that it's just, you know, we think of war and, of course, the battles. And
well,
you know.
Okay, think a lot of it's boring, believe it or not. Think of heat temperatures up around 100 degrees. Think of humidity. Over 75%. Think about working all day long, digging fighting holes or filling sandbags, digging in. Think about going on patrol for hours on end with little or no water or running out of water. Think about eating sea rations, maybe not having enough sea rations, maybe only having 2 sea rations a day. You become vigilant after a while. I mean, you are bone tired, but you are aware of everything that's going around you all the time. You don't sleep very soundly, but when you do sleep, you know that other Marines have got your back, got your six, as we call it.
And, you know, and I could see where almost like a mental fatigue could set in because of the drudgery, because you're not always just fighting. I mean, if you're fighting and you're here, oh my God, here's the moment. My life is here. My buddy's there, that sort of thing there. But that's not 100% of the time. And just that day-to-day.
Oh, it just come out of nowhere. Just expect the unexpected, like you said. You know, I told you that my little saying, no war ever goes as planned.
Right, yeah.
Expect the unexpected.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
It'll pop up when you least expect it.
Yeah, and that just that moment, and that's where, therefore, you know that. And so, therefore, you can't just all of a sudden just completely relax. You can never just completely let go.
That's correct.
That's
correct. Well, I got to walk amongst real heroes over there. I'm humbled by that.
It's a dynamic story. Now, and when I mentioned this earlier, Operation Allen Brook, and I apologize, I call it the battle, but the operation that seems to been a pretty significant episode time event.
Yes.
In your, talk about that.
Okay, let's do an overview of Operation Allen Brook. Operation Allen Brook started, I believe, officially was conducted May 4th through the 24th of August of 1968. That's May, June, July, August. So that's almost 3.5-4 months time frame. It was a multi-battalion operation. We were in what was called the Ganoi Island area, G-O, second word, capital N-O-I, It was called an island by the Marines because it really wasn't an island. It was surrounded by two major rivers when it rained during the monsoons. Mm-hmm. It was a rice-producing area, and it was an area that the North Vietnamese and the main force Viet Cong and the local Viet Cong built up every year, and they would mass troops down there underground. They had a lot of underground facilities. The objective was to get enough troops and enough rockets, 122 Russian rockets down there, and enough ammo and enough stockpiles, beans and bullets, to take out the Da Nang airstrip, which was billed as the busiest airstrip in the world in 1967, 68, 69, and 70. They literally had an airplane landing or taking off every 60 seconds on that airport, 24/7. Mm-hmm. But the operation was to go after the NVA and their supply catches and root them out of there. Mm-hmm. The overall results, it was five different battalions, the 7th Marines, the 5th Marines, the 26th Marines, and the 27th Marines. There were 1,100 enemy KIAs, over 1,100. I don't know. It's hard to say how many of them were down there. I can recite the order of battle to you if I look at the book. But that was another thing that Westmoreland's MACV, Military Assistance Command Vietnam, and the CIA had a running battle. The MACV had one set of numbers, and the CIA had another set of numbers. There was a fellow by the name of Sam Adams of the CIA that probably had the best handle on it of anybody, and I've found this out through my reading. His name was Sam Adams. If you take MACV's number and multiply it by three or four times, that was probably the true number of NVA that were in the area. So to make a long story short, but anyway, Westmoreland, and he had a running battle in their libel trial, or his libel trial against, was it NBC or ABC in 1973-74 time frame.
He sued
one of the television networks over a documentary that they had done about him. Mm-hmm. And Sam Adams was called in to testify.
He withdrew the
libel trial after he found out he wasn't going to win it.
When you look at the macro and the micro. Grady, the macro, so the people looking at the war over there, you know, the brainiacs in Washington, Westmoreland's in here, and, you know, is he sugarcoating some stuff here? And he kept telling LBJ, another 10,000, another 100,000, and I'll have it done, and this incremental buildup. And then that starts, we talk about PTSD.
It got out of hand. Mm-hmm. It got out of hand after a while.
Yeah.
Had they probably the guy they really needed to listen to was General Victor Krulak. They called him Brute Krulak. He was a World War II Marine. He was probably the most flamboyant and hard-nosed Marine there was around. He was in line to be commandant. He was Johnson had him come up to his office one time. The story goes, you can read about it. And I'll just tell you in effect what happened in a thumbnail sketch. He had him in his office. He said, "What do we need to do to win this war?" And Krulak told him. He says, "Go over to Tetrapone, west of Quezon, wipe out the head, the the Ho Chi Minh Trail. That's the that was the trailhead where it came down from North Vietnam. He says, bomb North Vietnam into the Stone Age. He said, let me take a 1st Marine Division up and cut half of North Vietnam off and bomb, or I mean mine Haiphong Harbor. And he says, we'll get the war over with in 5 or 6 months. And Johnson didn't like hearing that, so he got him up and walked him out. And he never became commandant of the Marine Corps after that.
Yeah, and it's just that...
anyway.
Yeah, the whole situation
He probably had the best handle on it of anybody.
That was the late then, 66?
That was 65, that he, 65, 66 that happened.
Okay.
I don't know the specific time.
Yeah, I'm trying to think, if we...
This is a loose recall on my part.
Right, and, as opposed to by 68, events start to set in.
68 was the turning point of the war.
Mm-hmm. And I'll let you, why do you say that then? I mean, I have my head in there, too. Why do you say it?
Well, the Tet Offensive. The Tet Offensive happened. It was beaten back. Severely, we won all those battles, but Cronkite, the most respected news anchor in America, said basically, I don't remember his exact words. Right. We're in a stalemate, a light bulb went on in the North Vietnamese upper level echelon. Says, well, we've got the news media on our side. We need to stay in this war and fight it like a counterinsurgency warfare. Let's pull our troops back, lick our wounds, and hit them, with guerrilla warfare and keep inflicting the wounds. He says. Their strategy was that the news media and the protests back home would be at their advantage.
Yeah, and the attrition and looking at the South Vietnamese, some will argue it was an artificial nation that it was cut off. After the French had left. That division there too. And that's a powerful dynamic in the whole equation.
That is correct. Now, that I haven't done a whole lot of research on. I do know that they had some bad units. They called them Arvins. Marvin the Arvins. Mm-hmm. but they had some good units. From the men that I've talked to in the military, the men that I know, I have a pretty good feeling that we probably could, if we had supplied them with beans and bullets and let their prime units, their really good units, fight the war, they probably would have held on and it had been like Korea is today, a North and a South Korea.
Yeah,
though that's a... like powder keg.
Exactly. And, how is that all going to end at some point?
Let's hope well.
Yeah, let's hope well. Exactly there. And then I thought of the early president, the first president of South Vietnam, and that was
Diem.
And then I was reminded when I was watching the Ken Burns series about his wife, Madame Nu.
Madame Nu, huh? Right.
She was, oh, my God. And when you look at the imperialistic aura that they surrounded themselves, that he was more than president, and then putting him in context, because when we think of Ho Chi Minh, the enemy and Uncle all this other, but the Vietnamese saw him as kind of like the father of their country,
right.
Because he's the one who really took it to the French, and he tried to form an alliance with the United States after World War II.
That's correct.
And was rebuffed.
Well, he didn't really, I'm not sure that it would be called alliance an alliance.
Yeah,
he asked for aid. He came to us and he said, he did it in the spirit of nationalism. He wanted to nationalize. It's pretty well known that he was a full-blooded communist, and it did turn out to be a communist nation. I think nowadays they've recognized that they've got to go with a little bit of capitalism to sustain themselves. So it's kind of funny how it's turned out, you know, these days. But yes, Diem. There's a lot of speculation about if Diem would have remained in power, and of course JFK helped
remove him.
Helped him, and then he got taken out, and what happened.
Yeah, and you know, and you go back. So it's such a complex story, because one thing it dawned on me when I was watching the series, the difference between Vietnam and Korea is that Korea was never really colonized.
Right.
And
right.
The Vietnamese were.
They did not want to be colonized.
No. Yeah. And that was the whole thing. And so when the French, after we win World War II, go right back in again. And, you know, so, you know, all that comes into play. It's just, it's not an easy,
no,
cut and dry situation.
It was very complicated.
And yet there's men on the ground. It's like you're in there and you're going like, I don't even know where I am. You know, didn't even know what way, how it was spelled.
Well, if I can tell you, if we figured out within a month to 2 months, every man that went in country figured out that we weren't there to win the war. This was, I'm talking 1968, 1969 time frame. But had they said, we're going to Hanoi, why every one of us would have been, let's go.
Right.
Or, well, not every one of us, but 99.8% of us would have said, let's go.
Right. Well, then it seems that then on that, because you would have a mission, a definable one, and you know, and a target, and you know, here we are. Yeah. As it is, like, it was interesting when you said, like, you know, you get sent over there in the late 60s, early 70s, and you go like, so why am I here? If we're not here to win the war, then why am I here?
We were there to stay alive and keep our buddies alive.
Yeah. I was struck, Grady, by one of the the last chapter, Casualties of War.
Oh, yeah.
And you wrote...
That's the unique part of the book.
Oh, I tell you. I mean, it's... and I'm not going to read the whole... but this one paragraph, you say, human bonding born of combat is part of the glue that holds a unit together. And upon returning home, most soldiers had to go around who had served or even understood the war. Grief sometimes erupted in rage. The silent rage was carried with so many and never discussed, and in grief manifested itself in withdrawal from society. And we touched on that a bit earlier, you know, about the...
post-traumatic stress.
Yes, sir. And... you know, we know the history that there wasn't these great big parades and so forth when the men came back home and met with derision and disrespect and so forth, too. That was, you know, and that's the post-war war, you know, because you come home, you've already been through the PTSD, it would cause a PTSD in the first place, and then to come home and to be rebuffed by your... You know, like, we can't even talk about this within our family.
I didn't even talk about it. I didn't tell anybody that I worked with. When I got back to work, I didn't tell anybody I was in the Marines in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Nobody wanted to hear that. Mm-hmm. This was in, you know, the early 70s. Mm-hmm. It was pretty disheartening. And, of course, you have survivor guilt. And you know, a majority of us, turned to, you know, alcohol. I never did do drugs. I drank a lot of beer in mm-hmm. the beginning, and of course I don't drink anymore. But but mm-hmm. yes, every one of us that came back had some or other degree of post-traumatic stress. I don't like to call it a disorder, post-traumatic stress, and it comes out in different ways. And a lot of different men.
Yeah, you had sent me a link, and I was struck by this article in the Washington Post here this past week. This brave ex-chaplain is still haunted by the Vietnam War's most desperate siege.
That's Chaplain Ray Stubbe. Mm-hmm. I don't know him personally. I do know some of the men that served with him in the 1st Battalion, 26th Marines. I happen to know Lieutenant Colonel Ken Pipes, who was Bravo Company commander at the time. And he was there with Ray Stubbe. There were some other guys there. Stevie Weiss, Ken Rogers, everybody that knows anything about Quezon knows Chaplain Ray Stubbe was the real deal up there, and that was a very nice article they did on him on the Washington Post here last week.
It was very struck because he was a chaplain.
He was a chaplain,
and out and. Officially a Lutheran, and then he talked about how the Catholic chaplain got blown up,
right?
You know, with the others, and there's these men, and he came and he created this service that was like 3 minutes in length because they didn't have much time to be around. It was like, it's just very profound.
That's correct. He's still he came to Denver. I got to meet him one time. He's a real kind of a reserved man, real nice man, a reverent man. But it affected him just like the rest of us. I don't think he was prepared for Vietnam, but he was after he came home. And of course, he still works, with the infirmed, and he's still a man of the cloth, man of God. And
how could anyone be prepared for like Vietnam?
You can't.
You can't. You simply have to go and be there, like Afghanistan today, whatever it is.
You can't be prepared for it.
Yeah. I just want to share. When I started your book, I have a ton of bookmarks around the house, and I just happened to grab this one. Didn't even think of it until I was, a good ways into it. And I'm going to read you this quote. It's from Chief Seattle, and he says, "When you know who you are, when your mission is clear, and you burn with the inner fire of unbreakable will, no cold can touch your heart, no deluge can dampen your purpose. You know that you are alive." And I was just
profound.
Your purpose, and this is what I'm hearing. I could just see all you guys around in a battle.
Well, I've come to believe that I was spared to tell this story, and what's unique about this book is the story about the casualties, I would have liked to. I wished I could tell everybody's story. But I had to pick some. I picked Danny Grimshaw from Washington State. God bless him. He was one of our heroes. He was a corpsman. I believe he's the last one that I talk about in the book. His brother, his little brother, and his sisters helped me put together that chapter. Believe me, this was this chapter was the hardest chapter for me to do. Stephen Austin, was in Charlie Company. I got to know his mother and his younger brother. His younger brother has a website for him, along with his company commander, Ronald Grunberg, Lieutenant Colonel Grunberg, and one of his men, Don Moorhead Sell, we're trying to, they've helped me. I'm doing the paperwork. We're trying to get Stephen Austin a Silver Star. It is up with the Secretary of the Navy right now, and we're hoping to hear something here soon about that. Danny Clevenger, she never knew her father. He's from Pueblo. Dan Clevenger. Danny, she lives here in Denver now. She never knew her father. She was born after he was killed. Mm-hmm. She's come to our reunions. God bless her. She's a fine young lady, and I was glad to be able to tell her dad's story others. That was a hard chapter for me to do.
And it's right at the end there. I can't tell you how profound I think the work is. I know it is, not think. In a way, it's an opus. I asked earlier, how much of this is memoir, And, you know, quite a bit, you know, because it's your experiences and so forth.
Yeah.
But I'm struck by how you, you know, you talk about the grand geopolitical. We talked about General Giap in North Vietnam and, you know, the Prime Minister Key and, you know, the interaction with Westmoreland with Johnson and, you know, all this stuff there. And yet you also bring it back to the very specifics. A day in the life of the soldier, and you saw, oh, it's boring, you know.
But, a Marine, not a soldier. Marine.
Thank you for correcting me. My brother, who's on the other side there, probably is going like,
your brother was a Marine.
Yeah, it's a Marine. Yes, not to say.
God bless him.
But, you know, and then to, you know, like you say, the casualties of war. And that's what, to me, it's the story is. And I think we very much owe it to ourselves as a country. We have our views on the war, you know, going in there, was it winnable? Was it a fool's errand? You know, yada, yada, yada. But in the big thing, it really comes down to the individuals that were in it and what you found there, your purpose and your heart and everything too.
Well, patriotism, I wanted to go, I've volunteered, I've wanted to serve my country, And I did. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
I think you still are.
Oh, I still am patriotic, yes.
You're still serving your country. You know,
it's a great country.
Yeah, and you're just bringing this story, you know, for the rest of us to read and to learn from.
Yeah.
You know, that's quite a bit.
Yeah.
Right there. Well, Grady, congratulations on it. I think it's an outstanding work. And that's a good Marine descriptor, right? Outstanding?
Outstanding.
Outstanding. There you go.
Thank you, Jerry. And I thank your audience also for listening.
And if people want to get the book?
Oh, yes. It's To the Sound of the Guns. 1st Battalion, 27th Marines from Hawaii to Vietnam, 1966 to 68. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And you can go to my website, and it'll guide and direct you to those sites also. GradyTBirdsong.com.
Right on. And we'll have this show uploaded onto my website, too, and it'll be repeated on Monday at this same time. So if you missed any part of it or, you know, certainly want to listen to it again because there's so much information here, by all means. And I'll have it on my website, jerryfabianic.com, under the Writer's Talk drop down there on KYGT Radio. And so we'll have it there, and we'll have that up there by the first next week here. So once again, I'm honored. I really appreciate you coming in here and talking about this. I'm starting to choke up a little bit just thinking about it because I had a brother who was a Marine.
Right.
And he might have been there with you. I don't know. We just don't
have
this.
You should find out what unit he was in.
Yeah, I've asked his sons, and they're not quite sure. You know, they're going to try to dig through papers and so forth. But just knowing his story.
I could help you.
Could you?
Yeah, sure. If you get his DD-214 and stuff like that, yeah.
All right, we'll talk off air. Maybe you can find some stuff out there.
Thank you very much, Jerry. God bless you.
You bet. All right, thanks, Grady. And all right, everyone, this is Jerry Fabian, KYGT, LPFM, 102.7, 103.9. And this has been Writer's Talk on the Rabbit Hole. And I will be back in 2 weeks with more writers and talking about their works. In the meantime, let's be safe, be kind, and let's take care of one another. And